So I did prepare what I call a teaching story for this evening. It was this dog has a habit, as sweet as he is and as dharmic as he is and enlightened, he actually is a barkaholic. And I live on the side of a hill on a canyon called Blythedale Canyon. And there's two pathways beside my house that go into the redwoods. And so there's deer and raccoons and possums and occasionally a coyote. And at night, if I leave him out, when the sun goes down, he will find his way over to the redwood grove and start barking at whatever critter is there, or even if there isn't a critter there. And when he starts, he doesn't stop. Now, this canyon has got homes built in it, but it's also very, very tree-lined. So it has a certain reverberation to it. And his bark carries all the way up and into the canyon. So the police have come up my hill 3 times to let me know that all the people in the canyon have been calling them and complaining about this little guy and how distressed and disturbed they are. And I always tell them, well, look, you know, I try not to let him go out, but when I open the door, he just skedaddles out before I can control him. And then when I follow him into the woods and whistle for him and call for him, he just goes further away from me. And so I just decided to settle in on the path, let him go where he wants to go, and just be there and try to calm myself and calm him down in association. Not that that ever worked. And as I was there, I realized that part of this canyon's shape makes his bark become an echo. And so one of the reasons that he doesn't stop barking is because he always hears the echo of his bark coming back at him. And he feels there's a dog out there that he's having a relationship with through this barking thing. And as I reflected on that, I realized that's a kind of a metaphor for us. This is our experience being human. You know, we chase after stuff. We bark, we do this compulsive behavior, you know, of either having this stuff go away if we're afraid of it or don't want it, or come towards us if we're attracted to it and desire it. And what we're really relating to is our own echo. Does that make sense? We're really continually getting excited and reacting to what we produce, a mirror of ourselves. That everything around us is caused and interpreted through our own experience and our own being and resonates with who we are. So this being the week of July 4th, which is a symbolic of freedom, and in this case it's freedom from the British, I like to celebrate it as liberation from ourselves. And in order to be more deeply, more profoundly, more specifically liberated from ourselves, we need to understand the echoes that we are reacting to passionately with our emotions, with our happiness, and with our sorrow, and with our jealousy and envy, and with our anger and resentment. Is really all a production that is self-made. We're really just chasing after and responding to our own echo. And if we can liberate ourselves from that, how to begin? So traditionally, in the Vipassana practice, the practice begins with the instruction to focus on the sensation of breathing. And what that does is it allows our awareness to become more and more centered, less scattered. Because if you notice, practicing in the middle of life, driving through the streets of San Francisco or waking up first thing in the morning, if we tune in, there's a constant storytelling system going on. It doesn't stop if we don't attend to it. It just goes underneath our conscious awareness. It never stops. And it's not like we're trying to solve a problem or that we can't effectively solve any problems by obsessing about that stuff that goes on in our heads, having been influenced by God knows what happened during the day or the year or the lifetime. But when we practice concentration and focus, the mind has a tendency to slow down and sometimes even become silent. And in the silence is the door to liberation. It's not in the noise. It's not in the thinking. It's not in the problem solving. It's not in the obsession or the review or the continual examination of what we've been experiencing. It's in silence. Now, the ultimate purpose of meditation is to enter through the portals into liberation. I know that we're kind of a secular Dharma group, and we don't, you know, we don't thump the scriptures, the Buddhist scriptures, but this is the underlying foundational principle of the practice, to become so concentrated that we incline towards silence, interior silence, so that we can find liberation. Liberation is not a permanent state, but when we enter it and experience it, even for a moment, we have the expanded understanding of who we really are through experience, not through the intellect, through direct and immediate knowing. Now, I had an experience like that in my first 10-day retreat. I was very, very, very focused in following the instructions because I was panicked out of my mind that I was committed to 10 days of being silent. So I was practicing lots and lots and lots of bringing the mind into focus and pointedness. And on the 10 o'clock sitting of the fifth day, the sun broke through the clouds, and the vibration in my hands, which I had been noticing for about a day and a half, because the instruction was, if there's physiological sensation, focus on them. So I've been focusing on the vibration in my hands. The sun broke through, and the minute that it hit the atmosphere in the sitting room, the vibration rushed up my arms and through my chest, and I had entered the absolute, in a sense. I had entered infinite light. It never has happened since, and I haven't chased it. But it was so powerful that it eliminated my deeply rooted depression. It eliminated my fear of intimacy and love. And it made me vow that I would do everything to help other people have this experience because it is so expansive and transformative that it eliminates a fear of death because I experienced what it was to be light, to dissolve the self. So self was not home, but all the lights were on. Awareness was present, even though I, as I knew myself to be, wasn't. So that immediate and direct experience creates such profound conviction and what they call faith, but faith based on experience, that it has guided me and energized me all these years. And I know that it will be my guide at the point that I die. And that's what I want from all of us. I want all of us to have the commitment to cultivate concentration enough that it can cut through the noise and take us to the portal of dissolution and the liberation of dissolution of self. That is the ultimate reason that we practice. I mean, practice helps us loosen up in day-to-day life. It helps us be more balanced and more familiar with our emotions and our reactions and how we identify ourselves and how we project and how we judge and all the infinite attitudes that we take to moment experience. But ultimately, it can take us right to the doorstep of liberation. And I wouldn't accept anything less. And the pathway to that is so simple that it's hard for our complicated minds to engage it with conviction. It simply means whether we're practicing in a position and committed to a 40-minute sitting, or we're walking on the streets or talking on the phone or brushing our teeth or watering our garden, to notice the noise in our mind. Wake up moment to moment and notice the stories that we're telling ourselves about what's been going on and who's been doing it to who and what is happening, and everything from politics to personal life to, you know, worries about money or what's going to happen or trying to control the future by reflecting and constantly obsessing about the past. We don't give ourselves the opportunity to experience how life takes care of itself without our having to manage it and micromanage it. Things take their place. All we need to do is have the clarity of our intention. We don't need more control than that. And life has a way of things all taking their proper place in good time. So part of dropping control is not living in stress and anxiety. And part of not living in stress and anxiety is stopping all the storytelling about how it's going to unfold. And trusting, just as every breath arises after another breath ends, every detail of life, moment to moment and breath by breath, will be appropriate, like the keys on a piano, one after another. They will create a melody that is okay, maybe divine. Trusting that we don't have to micromanage, because fundamentally we can't. It's pitting ourselves towards frustration. To try to micromanage how things will turn out. And we might realize when things turn out as we want that they don't satisfy us as much as we thought. And when things don't turn out as we want, it might be even better than we could have imagined. So there you go. That makes life more interesting when things are a little unmanaged, but still reflect to us who we are in a deep sense. Because micromanaging and controlling means that we want the future to reflect the self that we want to be, and not necessarily the self that we are at that moment. So we're constantly creating and manufacturing an image. That's part of the echo. So when we stop living in this fractal existence of all the echoes of self that we chase and manage and try to control and react to, when we stop that, we can get deeper into a more essential part of our nature. And when we get into our essence, it's naturally joyous, and it doesn't depend on conditions. You know, sometimes we feel like, oh, it's going to rain for a whole week, and it's winter, and the sun goes down at 4:30, and it's so bleak. But then, you know, we can make a hot cup of tea and sit and share the tea with a friend and make a fire in the fireplace, and all of a sudden it becomes incredibly cozy and it surprises us. So give life a chance to surprise us. So it doesn't have to break down the walls that we build around eventualities. So that it can naturally be playful and spontaneous, unpredictable and delightful, whether it presents pleasure or pain. We are amazed, we are surprised, because it really is out of our hands. And we can be more comfortable with realizing that it is out of our hands if we loosen the grip on who we think we are or who we ought to be. So liberating ourselves from the image that has been broadcast to us about who we are from the moment we're born, by society, by education, by family, parents, friends, lovers, enemies. Liberate ourselves from this cartography that we try to merge with. Surprise ourselves. You know, every time we look in the mirror, you notice just a few microseconds before we check out the image, we're already adjusting our mask. Why not be surprised with what we see from moment to moment in the mirror of our life? And be amazed at the complexity and the variety of who we can be. Liberate ourselves from the constant stories that we tell ourselves about what is going on in our lives, which really has nothing to do with the truth of things. We're constantly writing the novel, you know? So when Buddhist scripture tells us that there is no self, that's what it is pointing to. I like to call it not self. Anything that we struggle to be, anything that we can identify as ourselves, is not permanent, therefore not self. Any conception, any desire, motivation, intention to create a certain quality of self, it's not permanent. And even if we can achieve it for a second or two, what does it get us? Where does it get us? Is that true? Is there a foundation? Is there substance to that identity? No. So whatever we can articulate is not self. Anything that comes up, not self. So it's like cleaning out the closets until the closet is empty. I am not my slippers, I'm not my sweaters, I'm not my purses, I'm not my scarves. I'm not my underwear, I'm not my blouses, I'm not the linens that go on the bed. Anything else in the closet? I'm not the dust bunnies. I'm not those purses that I forgot I bought 2 years ago and never used. Anything else in there? Infinite. Infinite realities that hide in the closet of our identity. And you can just throw them out. Oh, I'm not this, not that, not this, not that, not this, not that. And you find that people want to say, yeah, you know, I've noticed that you have this tendency. I finally get who you are. No, no, no. Just as we can't identify who we are substantially, others can't either. So we don't have to take it so deeply when people try to tell us our characteristics, our qualities. That's just another way of imprisoning us, isn't it? In something that's not true because it's a projection and it's unsubstantiated. Liberate ourselves from the labels. I'm the third son, I'm a mother, I'm a teacher. I'm a driver, I'm a walker. I'm a coffee drinker, I'm a tea drinker. I'm a vegan, I eat meat. Infinite labels, infinite. Not one of them is an accurate description of who we are, or even a microcosmic description of who we are. So understanding that, give yourselves the opportunity to go for the ultimate trip, the ultimate liberation that is free of being identified as anything. We're just sensory beings in this state that we call being alive. And we are participating in something infinite and huge, unimaginable to our intellect. And there is something so expansive and downright blissful about that, as it's lighter. It is ultimate flexibility. Ultimate renewal and rebirth. Every moment and with every breath. We can go back to the drawing board of who we believe ourselves to be. Otherwise, we are shackled in a false identity with many, 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 many qualities. Some of them we defend, some of them we hide, some of them we share. But it becomes very contracted, smaller and smaller and smaller in the playground of being, which is infinite. So maybe if any of us are looking at the fireworks on the 4th, we can say, I want to be like those fireworks. I want to explode out of this contraction of who I believe myself to be and let all the light and all the energy dance in space and profoundly entertain with beauty self and others. That's what I wish for you this July 4th. Now it's your turn. And we have the roving microphone. You want to be in charge of the roving microphone? Think you know me. No comments, no questions. Yes? Yes? Did I hear somebody? Oh, okay.
I'll begin.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi.
I really loved your talk. Thank you.
Thank you.
And is it all right? Okay. I feel that knowing, I know that knowing that you talk about the ultimate, the essence, and I like living there. Until I walk out my door. My question is the balance of, and I get a good answer in myself, but sometimes you need those identities for self-protection. As a woman of color, as a woman of color with a disability, I get what is called the microaggressions from others around me. If not daily basis, at least every other day. So I'm wondering, how do you stay in that place?
Right. Having found paradise, can we live here forever?
Yeah, I guess that's what I want, even though.
Yeah.
Even though you have to deal with an asshole next. But next to you.
Yeah. Well, two things. Absolutely, we need to have what's called an ego to navigate this reality. Absolutely. But with practice, it becomes a lighter task. So, on the one hand, the identity, yes, you are a woman of color, yes, you might have a disability, but that's not the whole of your being. It's, you can expand beyond that, even though that's a true part of yourself. And it's an obvious part of yourself for other people to respond to, especially if they don't know you. But you know that that's their delusion when they're doing it. So there's insight weaving into that, which loosens it up, right? Okay, so that's the first thing. And the acknowledgement of that makes it a little less contractive and anxiety provoking to think about walking out the door. And it also has an effect on how we respond to everything that happens outside that door. Okay, so that's the first piece. But the second one is that we get insight and compassion for how other people respond to us, the more that we know ourselves. If they're going to be attacking us because of things that might be true about us in the limited sense, but don't know everything about us, then that's their suffering. That's their narrowness. And if it causes pain to us, that's our responsibility. We don't have to hit back. But the Dalai Lama said it, only suffering can only arise from suffering. So when suffering is inflicted on us, it arises from somebody who is in some state of suffering too. So after we take care of ourselves, we can also acknowledge with compassion, oh my goodness, they're in a very reduced universe, They don't have the flexibility and the bounce that I've cultivated through insight and wisdom and practice. Poor them. May I never run into them again. But that goes into controlling and defending and preventing. But I never resist a line that might get a laugh. Yeah. But you know, does that? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Andy.
It's on. Yes, everything that I hear you say is things that I've practiced over the years. And I practice 40 minutes in the morning and 45 in the evening, I sit. And it's wonderful while I'm doing it. It's when I leave that one space, the pillows, and go down and address Carol, and we have dinner together. And the tranquility and the emptiness will last maybe an hour. And it happens every day. You know, there's a little, not to offend anybody, but there's a little shit in every day, you know, and you can't get around it.
No, there's no reason to push shit away.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah. Shit's just shit.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah. But the thing is, that is one of the conundrums that people bring into practice, is how to translate it into daily life effectively. And for me, the most effective way is reminding myself. You know, so much of spiritual practice has got to do with what they call remembering. Remembering to pay attention to what's going on inside of our minds and our bodies. And coming back to that, when we're crossing the street, we might notice, oh, I'm talking to myself about that building across the way and the person that was in the doorway of that building 3 months ago and the way they looked at me. And, you know, it's constantly going on. And every time that our attention intersects with that flow of obsession, it has an impact of breaking it up. So when they say insight practice, because Vipassana used to be called insight meditation before it was called mindfulness practice, the insight is not a stream of philosophies about what's true. The insight is, oh my God, my mind is never silent. And look at the stuff that it's, you know, producing. It's never conclusive. It never solves a problem. It's just like this machine that goes on automatically all of the time. That's the insight into the nature of mind and what it produces. And there comes a point, Joseph Goldstein used to say, mind gets embarrassed and stops. Every now and then, the mind stops. Whether you're waiting for the bus, or brushing your teeth, or listening to the radio, or having dinner with your partner, you might notice, oh, wow, a moment of silence. And so that's acknowledgement that encourages the whole of what we call the self to go to that place more often, because recognition is there. And recognition is important in being able to arrive at that place again. But not with the hunger of having to have silence, you know what I mean? None of it is done with contractive intention. It's done with expansive intention. But for me, myself, it helps a lot. I was driving over here tonight. And I did this, I noticed, oh my God, my mind is, there were like 7 different topics that it was obsessing about, you know, in sequence, and then going round again. And then things that were going outside catch my attention, and stories would come out of that. I was listening to some guy, Martin Ball, I think his name is. He's from Ashland, Oregon. Very interesting character. And he's talking about how everything that we experience is part of fractal reality. And that our associative mind is creating fractal patterns of thoughts constantly. What I call associative resonance. And the more that we become aware of the nature of mind in that capacity, the more we become fascinated. Wow, the mind has infinite generativity. It can create 1,001 stories, like Scheherazade, you know, which I think is the meaning of that story, the Scheherazade story. And appreciate that the mind has that capacity, but not pay so much attention to it. Be aware of it and laugh at it. Oh my God, you're still ruminating about that. That's incredible, you know? And slowly the mind, like a dog, it begins to get trained and to enjoy silence itself. So when we're with another person, that's a good time to cultivate that. Listen to what my mind is saying as I'm listening to this person, because a lot of the time we're not really listening to them. We're preparing a response, we're having a reaction to what they're saying, we're having some kind of emotion about who we're seeing, and that person is just present in a very narrow way, rather than us witnessing the potential of that whole being. And especially if it's a long-term friend or partner, we have all these assumptions about who they are that we don't really pay attention, don't give life a chance every moment to be renewed. Or the people that we are close to, we don't give them a chance every moment to be renewed because we think we know who they are. Oh, I know what your response will be to this, so, you know, we live in a very assumptive universe that way, and that's an incredible limitation for us in terms of experiencing the fullness of being, the fullness of self-being, the fullness of all self-being, including the self in the other, right? Familiarity is very deadening if we allow it to be. You know, we realize so much when we lose something that we take for granted or that's been too familiar. You know, then something completely different turns on inside of us. We remember completely different facets of the person or of the animal or of the place when we can no longer see them for one reason or another. Then they come alive. But everything that we are familiar with feels deadened somehow. And so it's our responsibility to bring vitality of attention to every moment of experience. And in that way, to be fully alive, whatever our age, whether we die tomorrow or die in 10 years, this moment counts more fully when we are fresh in it. Right? Okay.
Back on?
Yeah.
So it sounds like you had a really powerful experience with your 10-day meditation retreat, and it's something I've been wanting to do for a long time.
I don't even know if they do 10 days anymore. It's been reduced to 6.
Really? Okay.
But, you know, someplace they might be still doing a 10-day retreat. It's right. A good time frame.
10 is or 6 is a...
6 is all right. 10 days is great. Because the first 3 days, the whole nervous system has to kind of slow down and regain its composure.
Right. And actually, if you could just speak to that, just to elaborate on that a little bit, just so that I understand, because I, you know, I meditate maybe a half an hour to an hour every day, and just the difference between something like that just accumulating into like going to someplace for a week or 10 days. Because I'm trying to pull the trigger, but part of me thinks I should be traveling.
There's nothing to compare an intentional, dedicated 10 days of practice in silence, which should, you know, ideally it starts at 6:30 in the morning and goes to 10 at night in silence. The only time you talk is when you have a meeting with your teacher, which is every other day. The depth of that and what it cuts through in terms of finding the source of being is incomparable to daily practice. After an experience like that, daily practice, but for most people, they will do daily practice for another 10 days, and then after that it starts dwindling down because the forces of conditions that exist in our day-to-day lives through activity are very powerful. And they're especially powerful because we're unconscious of them. So when the first 3 days were troubling for me. I mean, it was problematic. And for most people, that's the challenge. After that, it's smooth sailing. When you realize that you only have 2 or 3 days left, you go into grief because you don't want to leave. The outside world and the experience that we get completely absorbed into looks so weird and meaningless and, you know, kind of distant from the source that we're connecting to, that there's a resistance. And you'd say, you know, and actually I used to organize retreats and people would sign on for 2 weeks, but I'd rent a place for 3 months. And guess what? Most people signed on for the full 3 months. And then after a while, they'd say, okay, from this retreat, I'm going to find another 3-month retreat. And that was how a lot of my generation traveled the world, from retreat to retreat, because there's an inclination to not re-enter the world that we thought we had left. But even in Buddhist sutras, it says you can get completely released, but then you come back. So it's the bodhisattva path of coming back and infusing this reality with that level of wisdom and insight. And that's where wisdom lies. Then you can see through, cut through the conditions of this life more usefully. And then it opens up like a fruit and becomes something much more dynamic and alive. So I recommend it. You know, I mean, it's a sacrifice. You have to, you know, leave your work or not go to Hawaii instead, you know, or, you know, whatever. I was teaching and I had to take 10 days off. You know, didn't have the comfort of my home. All of that doesn't matter. You go into this space and everything that mattered before has a different shading to it. But you're not going to lose the old conditioning easily, you know. There's something very, very compelling about the world that civilization and society has created for us. And it's all reinforced. We all reinforce it with each other and with the structures that we build and the behaviors that we encourage and the schedules and the regularity and the have-tos and the musts. They all fall back into place, but like I said, the more we practice, the more there's aeration in that. And that's when we have free choice. Others than that, we're mechanical. Like Gurdjieff says, we're automatic mechanical beasts, just reacting to the way that we've been conditioned. And so that's another way that mindfulness is a liberation process. It liberates us from our mechanistic reactive self. Mechanistic, reactive, repetitive, deadening self. So that's my pitch. Did it work? We'll find out. Okay. Yeah, I mean, in a way, to take 10 days off and to dedicate that level of depth of practice where from the outside it looks like we're doing absolutely nothing, right? It's an extraordinary indulgence. Everything is taken care of for you. The food is made for you. The beds are available. Retreats are always held in places that are beautiful and natural. Teachers dedicate themselves to helping out. Because we're practicing too, you know. So there's an incredible caretaking, indulgent quality because there's a recognition of the hard work that you are doing, that we are doing when we practice. Because there are times when it gets rough. Okay. So, we just have a few minutes left, so let's just reconstitute for just a few minutes of meditating before we go back out into that world we've been talking about.